Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, you know, we here at the Brian Lehrer Show are not a competitive bunch. We work together in a supportive environment to bring you news and conversation each day. But the gloves were off 2 weeks ago at the first ever Brian Lehrer Show intern ping pong showdown. It's actually producers and host and interns. Producer Paige Cowett bested all comers, as it turned out, beating us handily through her strategy of calmly returning the ball to our side of the net and waiting for her opponent to screw up aggressively on their own, which happened over and over until Paige was crowned champion. The next crop of interns, and in turn the next ping pong tournament, is just 2 weeks away, so we're all sharpening our backhands and practicing our spin serves. We'll let you know what happens. But I mention all this because joining me in studio right now are the authors of a new book called Everything You Know Is Pong, which I originally thought was about something else when I saw the title, something you consume in liquid version, but it's actually about ping pong. Eli Horowitz is an editor at McSweeney's, the brainy San Francisco-based publishing house founded by Dave Eggers. Roger Bennett is a sports, music, and culture writer based here in New York, and their new book has contributions from an unlikely group of ping pong aficionados. Puzzle master Will Shortz, author Jonathan Safran Foer, Davey Rothbart of Found Magazine and This American Life, and many others. So, Eli, Roger, welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Hi. Thanks for having us on.
And listeners, we're going to sneak in some phone calls on this. So if you are a ping pong player and want to talk about what the game means to you or to go to the subtitle of the book, How Ping Pong Explains the World, give us a call right now, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Will Shortz, are you out there today? Or leave a comment on our show page, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, where you can see a photo from our recent Brian Lehrer Show ping pong tournament showdown.
We need to get ESPN down to cover the next one, Brian.
Absolutely. Or maybe ESPN2. But take us to 1955. Let's start with the story of Fidel Castro, a fateful visit to New York City, and how ping pong led the Cuban Revolution.
Oh, sure. I mean, well, with Castro, it's really a full decade of ping pong for him, because in the early 50s, he was this kind of earnest, somewhat pathetic lawyer trying to get in the legislature. Then in 52, Hiroji Sato wins the ping pong world championships in Bombay, and it was this big upset, this big revolutionary thing with the sponge paddle, very controversial. And that sort of gave Castro the belief that he could be a revolutionary. Still, he wasn't very good at it, led one revolution, failed, gets thrown in jail, exiled. Then in 55, he comes to New York for a fundraiser. This part is not totally confirmed, but we theorize after this fundraiser at the Palm Garden Hotel, he walks three blocks to the Lawrence's Broadway courts, this ping pong emporium.
Legendary.
The very best U.S. players, Dick Miles, Marty Reisman, all of them. And this sort of taught Castro what he needed, a certain American revolutionary spirit that he brought back to Cuba. Within a few months, he was leading a new revolution with Che, and then soon he was celebrating the streets of Havana.
All because of ping pong.
Well, it seems speculative, but then later on he was asked, what was the secret of the revolution? And he answered, I learned from ping pong, hit it where they least expect it.
Like ping pong, you hit them where they least expect it.
When we were putting the book together, Brian, we found dozens of photographs of Castro on the battlefield, playing as he liked to play, which was pants only, bare-chested, either a chest wig or a very, very manly display of hair on the chest, just thwarting all oncomers with crowds behind him. It's a beautiful, beautiful image.
Is Castro the most surprising ping pong enthusiast? You have pictures of Bill and Hillary Clinton playing on the campaign trail in 1992, members of Buffalo Bill's traveling circus playing in 1890, Buddhist monks playing at a monastery in China.
I would say at this point the only surprise would be if there wasn't a photograph of someone playing ping pong.
We couldn't agree more. I mean, we've been collecting for about a dozen years images, photographs, memorabilia, marketing materials, advertising from the 1930s onwards, and we began to realize that ping pong, while one of the world's most favorite sports that cried out to be returned to its pedestal, was everywhere, the honest truth was its DNA was secreted on every major story of the 20th century, from the suburbanization of America to the rise of China, and we wanted to tell these stories.
In fact, you devote a whole chapter to how ping pong is a symbol of the suburbanization of America.
Which it absolutely is. I mean, we collected over 400 advertising images from the 1940s, the post-war boom, Brian. And we realized that the marketers needed to sell Americans, that the city needed to be left behind, and the outer core, the suburb, needed to be embraced. And they had a slight marketing problem, which was if they were to show the houses, it was pretty repulsive. They all looked the same, as far as the eye could see, kind of potato-cut houses. And so they came across a brilliant solution. And if in ad after ad after ad from that time period, they realized they could sell the city dwellers on the one thing they craved, which was space, a finished basement. And what said finished basement more than the humble ping-pong table, kids playing, dad losing, mum serving up some cakes adoringly. Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, was coming out at the same time, letting us know how miserable mum actually was. But in every image, ping pong brought the family together, and it looked so wonderfully glorious.
And Paige admitted that she grew up in a house with a ping pong table. That's why she's the Brian Lehrer Show producer ping pong champion. I grew up in a house in Queens with small basement, and we had a ping pong table, and it was a ping pong table where you had to stand in one spot because the basement was that size in order to play. But that's how we used the space. It was a ping pong table. Cole in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, Brian. Thanks. It brings people together. It's a simple game, and everyone loves to play, whether you're a novice or an expert. And I used to live in California, and I worked in a manufacturing facility with a bunch of Chinese people. And they taught me everything they knew, and we had three ping pong tables. And I went from being a novice, not knowing anything, to beating them every day at their own game.
And it felt darn good, didn't it?
It sure did.
Thank you for your call. My guests on WNYC are the authors of a new book called Everything You Know Is Pong, How Ping Pong Explains the World. How does it explain the world for you? 212-433-WNYC. Do you have any advice about how to improve your game? Like, take a listen. How do you go from this to this?
Was that you taping Eli and I in the green room, Brian?
Oh yes. You're that good, are you? Have to get a table for the green room now that you mention it.
I think the answer is it all depends on the velour and the terry cloth that you're wearing. Changes your whole game.
More velour, the better. And just losing a lot. That's the other secret.
Velour, terry cloth, is that a ping pong thing?
Well, Howard Jacobson, the Booker Prize winner who wrote a beautiful love letter to the game in our book, he says that literally he stays up all night only dreaming of table tennis and that he only dreams not of the great glorious moments in his life because he's played ever since, like Cole, your caller, ever since he was about 8 or 9. He says he's obsessed with the points that you lose and the games that he's lost. And he said that's what prepares you to be a great writer, to be a great ping pong player, because death is inextricably connected to ping pong.
Whoa. And we mentioned that Jonathan Safran Foer writes in your book, contributes to your book, others who are ping pong enthusiasts. Susan Sarandon is co-owner of the ping pong club Spin here in New York City. You held a celebrity tournament last week in which Judah Friedlander of 30 Rock beat Will Shortz.
It was an amazing game. I mean, this was a serious, serious, serious game. Everyone was sort of agog. And Shortz is a serious, serious player, but Judah, he really showed us something out there.
Will Shortz is opening up his own ping pong club in Pleasantville. In our book, he documents how he became the man in the world who has visited the most ping pong clubs in North America. He is one of the most remarkable gentlemen and a role model for American youth.
I'm going to interrupt for just a second with a story that's breaking across the wires right now. The House Ethics Committee has found Congressman Rangel guilty of violating ethics rules. We'll bring you more details in the news coming up in just a few minutes, but there is now a guilty verdict in from that House Ethics subcommittee, technically, that held those proceedings yesterday, and we'll bring you details as soon as we get them. And our news is just about 3 minutes away. So your book is called Everything You Know About Pong, not a bad punny title at all. So all morning on Twitter, we've been asking people for their Pong punts. We got things started with our suggestion of the Pong Kiss Goodnight and Walt Whitman's Pong of Myself. People are responding using the hashtag #PongPuns. So here are some highlights. And listeners, you know, again, if you want to tweet us some Pong puns, it's #PongPuns. B. Burbank wrote, "If this is Pong, I don't want to be right." David and Coyle wrote, "King Pong." Matt wrote, "Chairman Mao said Pong. And a Pong's Day journey in tonight." They are puns, after all. NPR Books wrote, "Pong of Solomon." Vedetta Jones, "The Pong remains the same." A lot of them are using song. "I've got a Pong in my heart." No amount of experimentation. This is an Albert Einstein quote. "No amount of experimentation can ever prove me right. A single experiment can prove me Pong." So
we've got our next 17 books all lined up for us.
I'm not sure you quite do. We mentioned the club Spin NYC, Susan Sarandon, which is a celebrity hotspot of sorts. Are people doing business deals over ping pong now? Is this the new squash? Is this the new brunch?
I think it would bring the deals together, but then it would fracture them quite quickly. You may start the deal during the game, but by the end there'll be no more negotiation.
There can only be one winner, Brian. I mean, ping pong is coming back, as your listener, Cole, seemed to reflect. Whenever we talked about this project while we were putting it together over the past dozen years, it just takes people back to an incredibly happy place, mostly in the basement like yours in Queens, to a very, very happy time. And I think at the core of this book, it is a celebration of everything that the sport can be.
Now, there are no lyrics in this song, but... do you know the Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers 1961 classic?
It's on the tip of our tongue, but put us out of our misery, Brian.
Called Ping Pong. Lee Morgan on trumpet, Wayne Shorter on tenor, Bobby Timmons on piano, Art Blakey on drums.
We have a chapter in the book of great ping pong music. Our favorite, the 1980s Belgian punk Plastique Bertrand, who had a number one hit with Sa Plan Pour Moi in 27 countries, followed it up with a follow-up, Ping Pong, and it failed to chart anywhere outside of Italy. His career was
Eli over. Eli and Roger, authors of Everything You Know is Pong. Thank you so much.